Thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly, hour-long news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs. From across Vancouver and the Lower Mainland, my name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Zoe Power.
And I'm Adeline Payne.
It's Thursday, July 26th at 5:05 p.m., and we're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Today on Democracy Watch, we have part one of a series on how the national legalization of marijuana will affect Vancouver consumers and businesses. This timely series is called It's Not Weed, It's Not Pot, It's the Cannabis Industry. What a great name. And this particular episode of that series is an intro to the topic of national weed legalization with input from industry reporters and experts.
After that, we will be broadcasting the latest episode of our new Vancouver Civic Election podcast, Seeking Office. This episode is part one of the docuseries, How We Got Here. It's all about the history of Vision Vancouver, the party that has dominated Vancouver civic politics for the past decade. It features the voices of Mayor Gregor Robertson, Councillors Heather Deal and Diego Cardona, former COPE's Councillor Ann Roberts, and veteran City Hall reporter Francis Bula.
And the final story we have for you today is a fun one. News Collective reporters, myself, Zoe Power, and Aidan Tong bring you an update on the sharks of the West Coast in honour of the Discovery Channel's annual Shark Week program. Content warning, there is obnoxious Australian accents featured in that content. But for now, we're going to turn to the first story of the day. It's called It's Not Weed, It's Not Pot, It's the Cannabis Industry.
There's just overwhelming and growing scientific and medical evidence about the bad long-term effects of marijuana. We've spent a couple of generations trying to reduce the usage of tobacco in Canada with a lot of success. Tobacco is a product that does a lot of damage. Marijuana is infinitely worse, and it's something we do not want to encourage. Obviously, our programs are aimed at trying to treat people who have drug addictions, but we maintain tough laws against those who traffic in substances, who profit off of destroying people's health.
That was Canada's previous Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, sharing his opinion on marijuana before the last federal election in 2015. But now Justin Trudeau is in charge, and recreational cannabis is being legalized. What do those who work in the cannabis industry want the public to know? Here's Alex Robb, owner of Trees Dispensary on Vancouver Island.
One thing I would say is come and check us out. What I mean by that is that a lot of people might associate cannabis stores with just selling the flower product that is to be smoked, or maybe selling edibles that get you super high. But I think that people should be aware of all the different kinds of products that are currently available on the market, which include things that have no psychoactive effect. They're just rubs that really work for eliminating aches and pains. There's massage oils that really do help the body relax more than other massage oils. I think that people would be surprised to learn the number and variety of products that are out there, as well as their effects. Another example would be low-dose CBD capsules. Like many people who have no interest in getting high use low-dose CBD capsules as a regular vitamin that they find helps their sleep, reduces anxiety, makes them feel better generally, and doesn't have any psychoactive effect. This is a product that I think is going to have much broader appeal than many people assume when they just associate it with the idea of stoners or getting high. So I think that that's one thing that I would say to the general public is come and see what is available to you, because it's not just about getting high. There's a wide variety of products that are about feeling better and feeling healthier.
So Alex wants the public to come visit their local cannabis retailers and to know that cannabis products are not limited to simply getting you high. Calvin Ho from Greenline feels the same way. Greenline is a point-of-sale software company that helps cannabis retailers with inventory management and compliance with government regulations.
Yeah, and just to add on to that, I have personal friends and family that have benefited from, say, CBD-derived arthritis balms. They also have a particular brand of CBD treats for pets and for elderly dogs with joint pain, and that seems to have increased the energy levels of your dogs and your other pets. I mean, there is still a lot of cultural stigma to overcome. Cannabis prohibition has lasted 95 years, but I believe the cannabis can bring that positive societal impact as both medication and economic strength that's unique to Canada. And just to also mimic what Alex has said, the best way to get a good idea of what's going on in the industry today is simply visit a nice store.
On the same topic, here's what Michael Hoffweller from Leaf Forward had to say. Leaf Forward operates in Canada and Australia. They provide community events for cannabis entrepreneurs, and they're moving into providing an accelerator program for early-stage cannabis companies. He's also opening GrowWorks, a cannabis business hub in Vancouver for startups and established businesses.
Leaf's great because it really gives people an opportunity to really get a purview into the professional cannabis space. And as an emerging market, as a brand new industry, I think it's really important for people to get the negative connotation of this whole sort of stoner kind of vibe, right? And it's actually moving into a professional, modern industry. So you're seeing startups and software pop up, you're seeing manufacturing companies pop up, you're seeing innovation happen, and that's really cool. So that's one project.
So the cannabis industry is rebranding itself in preparation for legalization, but how much growth is to be expected in a city where cannabis is already so prominent?
To put it lightly, I would say boom. It's pretty much like a fire hose of energy being kind of coming out of the woodwork right now. So you're seeing licensed producers right now growing at incredible rates, opening up new farms, lots of diversification, lots of new entrants happening. So what you're seeing right now is a lot of licensed producers like Aurora and Canopy Growth doubling down, building up massive facilities. I think Aurora Sky is like a 1 million-square-foot processing facility, which is just absolutely massive. And so you're seeing a lot of other smaller players emerge as well, these micro-cultivators, as you call them. So this is sort of stage one of the industry, where there's a lot of new companies popping up, and not just growers, because everyone thinks weed's all about the growing. It's not just about the growing. There's a lot of companies emerging about that are doing extract production, or let's say point of sale software for dispensaries and things like that, or who are offering consulting on regulatory compliance. And so you're also seeing new companies popping up in sort of white label manufacturing for like cannabis packaging and stuff like that. And there's just a plethora of stuff that's emerging. So and another interesting thing is like the drink market is going to be a $1 billion market in Canada. So CBD and THC infused beverages, huge. So a lot of the big beverage manufacturers right now, like Anheuser-Busch and things like that, they're trying to diversify into creating CBD and THC products for the market. So you're going to see a lot of, let's say, edibles, and you'll see a lot of like drink startups emerging as well. So there's a lot of companies that are just trying to break into the scene, and I mean, and understandably so. It's going to be a multi-billion-dollar industry, and I mean, everybody, like most people, smoke weed. I would say, I mean, if they don't, they still probably do. But so you're seeing a lot of that growth now, and this is phase one. Phase two is the phase that a lot of these entrepreneurs are probably more excited about, and that's the consolidation phase. And what that means is you've got a whole bunch of players entering the market, a whole bunch of new businesses starting, a whole bunch of new startups emerging. Then you've got these big players like Roar and Canopy with multi-million-dollar budgets, and consolidation means they're going to buy all the small players that work.
But as Calvin points out, this growth is in constant flux.
There are constant openings and closures of dispensaries. I mean, if you just do a quick online sort of aggregate search of what exists now, about 10 to 15% of the stores that are existing now didn't last month, and vice versa. It's always in flux, and it's really difficult to get that question.
Since there's going to be so much growth, regulation through legislation will be a complicated process, and one that hasn't finished yet. Here are Alex and Calvin's thoughts on the current and upcoming legislative changes.
At Trees, we've been paying a lot of attention to that. Obviously, we're applying for numerous provincial licenses. We are also seeking to obtain a federal license for processing product. Hmm. And so as part of this, the politics around legalization, British Columbia, which has a large, long-standing cannabis industry, lobbied the federal government to create some kind of way that the smaller producers could get in. So it wasn't just going to be these companies that had been licensed under the federal government's marijuana for medical purposes regulations that are these corporate, like they've got they're forced by Health Canada to build, you know, secure, like, these vaults, tremendous sized vaults and fortresses that people are familiar with, these concrete fortresses. And so they were the ones that were the only ones designated to provide for the legal marketplace. BC really did push the federal government to include a way that the small producers, micro-cultivators, could be in. So the Health Canada created a category of license called micro-cultivation, which allows somebody to be licensed to produce a certain amount of, as much cannabis as they can produce in 200 square meters of canopy space. And so this allows a way for people who want to be small business people, a team of three or four, to set up 100 lights and to be able to provide for the legal market. So the BC really was trying to push the federal government to come up with a way that the existing small producers could get into the system. But that's sort of unique to BC. No other province has really been trying to do that way. They've been happy with the existing corporate structure. So what we want to do is we also want to set up a federally licensed processing facility for processing the products of these small cultivators, essentially pursuing the same business model that we have right now, meeting small growers up and down the island, providing quality assurance and testing for their product, and then packaging it into gram or eighth bags and retailing it to the public. So that's, we're quite familiar with the process from both the provincial, federal, and municipal levels. That's something that's really interesting about the politics of legalization in Canada today, is how it's involved three different levels of government in every different province to sort of work together on a project, each of them having to use their powers in different ways in order to create these regulations on the fly and kind of in a rush, which is why you're getting such a patchwork of different systems arising out of Canada. It's pretty fascinating for a student of politics to sort of watch how this is evolving today in Canada.
Now Calvin introduces some current legislative models for cannabis across Canada and emphasizes that, like Alberta, BC will have a model that represents a private-public split, meaning that you will be able to buy cannabis from both private and public retailers.
So as for the proposed legislation, the key thing here is that it varies so dramatically from province to province. Let me give you a quick little overview on the four most exciting ones, in my opinion. So first off, you have the Ontario model, which is essentially a government monopoly on cannabis retail through the Ontario Cannabis Store. So all online sales and physical retail will be through the government, and it's a very tight grip on the recreational market. Whereas in Saskatchewan, you have a very privatized system where they allow for private wholesale distribution and retail, as well as online stores and e-commerce. From there, Alberta is adopting a system where it's a private-public split, much like what we're about to see in BC, except they're further down the road, where they will have government wholesalers that will handle the taking in of cannabis supply from the licensed producers and then distributing that amongst private retailers. However, there is no private e-commerce in Alberta. BC is probably the one province with the least amount of structure as of right now. The LCRB, so that Liquor and Cannabis Regulation Branch, their application portal is not yet online, but the general framework for the process is available. My main concern with all of these models when it comes to how they're set out is mostly on the Ontario front, where they're slated to have 40 stores by July 2019 and up to 150 by 2020. But the issue here is that Ontario has a population of 13 million, and that may not be enough to supply the market, which will enable the black market to still occupy pockets of the province, whereas BC has a population of about 4 million and well over 150 stores already, licensed or unlicensed.
On the same topic of legislation, this is what Glenn Korstrom had to say. Glenn is a journalist at Business in Vancouver who covers hospitality, tourism, cannabis, and liquor policies. He is also the editor of Cannabis magazine.
One thing Health Canada is right now consulting on, and this only really came to light yesterday, is a proposed, I think it's 2.5%, it's like a tax on the gross revenue of licensed producers or the growers of cannabis, and the government saying that the rationale is to cover costs, but there's no other sector that they are doing that with, so that's one way that they are treating cannabis differently.
So is that in a sense like a cash grab from government?
It would seem to be, yeah. Justin Trudeau has been clear all along that the one of the main goals for legalization is to eliminate the black market or diminish the black market. But if they're going to have a lot of taxes, then they aren't going to do that. But before yesterday, the presumption was that the only tax would be an excise tax of 10% that would be split between the province and the feds, with the provinces getting 75% of that. And now it seems like there could be another 2.5% tax. So that would push the tax up, because the growers will pass that on. And it just will make it more difficult to crack the black market, which many people I've chatted with, like Dana Larson, believes the black market is going to continue to flourish.
This was part one of It's Not Weed, It's Not Pot, It's the Cannabis Industry. Stay tuned for part two coming soon. The segment you just heard was produced by Zubin Shroff Mirabidi and Adeline Peng. The Stephen Harper opening clip was courtesy of Canadian Press YouTube channel. And as always, thank you to Alex DeBoer, our informative interviewees, and everyone who made this segment possible.
We're kicking off Pride at UBC in style with a free daytime event. On August 1st, sashay your way to the U Commons area outside the Nest from 4 p.m. onwards to celebrate diversity, inclusion, and positive space at UBC. There will be a public disco with feel-good disco and house anthems, craft beer, and a drag and dress-up trunk. There will also be live mural painting with a selection of food trucks on site with special Pride-themed menus. Come to UBC Pride on August 1st.
You forgot the surfboards? How are we going to shred the gnarly waves now?
Well, I got just the replacement. I picked up some copies of Discorder instead.
Well, it looks like this surf day just got a whole lot better.
This extra special summer issue of Discorder features interviews with local punk rockers Lié, queer Métis fashion designer Evan Ducharme, and the hosts of CITR's Radio Pizza Party. There will also be an exclusive Bartholomew comic strip, short fiction by Mac Gordon, and a suggested summer reading list compiled by the staff of Massey Books. And of course, there will be reviews of the Music Waste and Sled Island Music Festivals, as well as podcasts, films, and more. Thank you to our advertisers Blueprint, Timber Concerts, The Cinematheque, Rickshaw Theatre, Mint Records, Hexistential Festival, Current Symposium, Audiopile, and An Evening in Damascus.
And we're back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard part one of our series on how marijuana legalization will affect Vancouver. Stay tuned for part two, coming soon. We're now going to turn to the latest episode of our civic election podcast, Seeking Office. This episode is part one of a series called How We Got Here. This series is meant to provide context for the how and why of how Vancouver municipal government functions today. Take a listen now to A History of Vision Vancouver to learn how this civic party has held control of the city for the last 10 years.
You're listening to Seeking Office, the Vancouver Municipal Election Podcast.
So why did you decide not to run for mayor again?
Well, I decided personally it's time for me to make change and tackle something new in my life, and also wanted to make space and, you know, invite others to get into politics in Vancouver and new leadership. We got so many great young people, diverse people, want to be engaged in politics more directly. So those of us that have been in it for a long time, for me it's almost 10 years as mayor, so I think it's important to make room when the time comes.
On Sunday, July 8th, Vision Vancouver voted in their final slate of candidates for City Council and Park Board. After holding majority on council and the mayor's seat for nearly a decade, Vision is running a new cohort of candidates in the 2018 civic election, a cohort that's been credited for their diversity in age, gender identity, and ethnic background.
My name is Aaron Leung.
My name is Diego Cardona.
My name is Wei Chao.
It's clear Vision is changing, but aside from becoming more diverse, what are they changing from? Where did Vision begin, and how did it come to rule Vancouver for the past 10 years?
Role within Vision Vancouver?
Yeah, so my name is Diego Cardona and I'm currently a candidate for a city council nomination with the party.
So on Sunday, July 8th, myself, Alex DeBoer, and Zubin Shroff Marabudi headed down to Creekside Community Center in Olympic Village because we knew Vision members were voting in their choices for city council and park board that day. All of the other Vision candidates, incumbents, and their school board trustees had already been decided on. While waiting outside the voting room, Zubin and I had a chance to talk with Vision Vancouver City Council hopeful Diego Cardona. Both Zubin and I had heard of Diego. His age had been commented on a lot in the media. He's only 23. We also knew him because he ran for City Council unsuccessfully in the 2017 by-election under Vision's banner. He was beat out by Hector Bremner, who took the council seat, as well as three other candidates who got more votes than him. So in that most recent election, Diego came fifth. And that's something we wanted to talk to him about, to ask him if he found that by-election loss disheartening, and if it means Vision is losing grip on power. We also wanted to talk to him about the other rock in Vision's shoe, the fact that Vancouver's worst housing crisis happened on their watch. We asked Diego about this, and he says Vision is better equipped to deal with the housing crisis now, that they have fresh ideas.
Show the entire city that although we've been in government for 10 years, we actually have some fresh people and fresh voices and fresh ideas to carry forward our legacy.
And what are some of those fresh ideas? Like, how is Vision different now than it has been over the last 10 years?
Well, I think the first thing is who we're bringing to the table. If you look at the candidates that are coming forward, they're young, they come from racialized communities, they come from a diversity of identities in terms of gender, sexual orientation, socioeconomic status. So the first thing is we're telling people we're trying to put forward a slate that looks like today's Vancouver, and I think that's a big change. And I think the other one is that these are all people that are directly affected in their everyday life by the affordability crisis. So we're telling Vancouver that we're taking this crisis seriously and we're going to put forward solutions to address it.
So Diego remains hopeful that Vision might remedy the housing crisis if they're elected again. He says things are different now that Vancouver has friendly federal and provincial governments to work with on this issue, and that Vision could very well return to power with the support they need to tackle the crisis. Plus, Diego says he's listening. He's heard the hurt from voters, and he's taken away a clear message that he would bring with him to office if elected.
People want us to empathize more, and I got that loud and clear.
Okay, yeah. Cool. And so, yeah, the new slate of candidates are bringing more empathy and a harder stance on tackling affordable housing.
Yeah, I think we all have to, like, I think this is the issue in this election, right? So, like, we all have to be very clear about it. And those of us who are part of the slate, like, I think most of us are going to be renters, which is a change for any political party. So Vision, MPA, whatever it is, like, to have a majority of your slate that are actually renters, so that actually reflects the majority of Vancouver, I think it's going to change the conversation too.
And in response to placing fifth in the 2017 by-election, Diego says that doesn't necessarily mean the party is losing popularity. There were three school board trustees voted in that same by-election, he adds.
I think it puts the entire city at risk.
At Sunday's vote, we also spoke with Aaron Leung, a 21-year-old Vision school board hopeful, as well as city council candidate Wei Chao Jung. Wei, like Diego, is an immigrant to Canada. He moved here from China 15 years ago and says his background allows him to connect with different Chinese-Canadian demographics in Vancouver.
My name is Heather Deal, and I'm a Vision Vancouver City Councillor. I'm an incumbent, and we'll be running again as a candidate this
Zubin fall. Zubin and I also talked to incumbent City Councillor Heather Deal, the only Vision City Councillor to seek re-election this year. Being the only returning Vision Councillor out of five, Heather knows that this municipal election will bring change, even if Vision maintains the same number of seats they currently hold.
Well, there will be change. I mean, we have so many incumbents who've chosen not to run. The other parties are putting forward new candidates as well, so there will be change. There's no question of that. Again, I'm proud of our work and I stand on our record, but we also know that there's a trend in politics for people to look for change about every 10 years, and we're seeing that. I'm very, very proud of the candidates that we have. They're rock solid. I had a very difficult time deciding which ones to vote for today. It was a toughie because they all had amazing credentials and a good variety of backgrounds and credentials and knowledge bases that we need. So I'm hoping they all stay involved. But if we win all those seats and keep a majority of the mayor plus five, that would be awesome. And if we don't, I'm prepared to work with other councillors and other parties to make sure that the projects I really care about move forward.
Voters tend to look for change about every 10 years. Perhaps in anticipation of this, Gregor Robertson, Vancouver's mayor since 2008, chose not to seek re-election this year. While at Sunday's vote, we asked him to reflect on his time with Vision Vancouver and how it's changed over the past decade.
Maybe if you could just say a major difference between Vision now and Vision when you started 10 years ago, what has most changed?
Well, I'd say Vision is predictable over the years and being, you know, very diverse, really reflecting the diversity of Vancouver. And that's like geographically across the city, all the neighborhoods represented with members and elected officials and many of the different cultures of Vancouver too. And that's really how we came into, I think, majorities getting elected, is we reflected the diversity of the city, I think, more clearly than other parties, and obviously the priorities have been consistent too, and focusing on affordable housing and homelessness has always been a big goal for us, a really tough challenge in Vancouver, but we will never give up on that one, and greening our city, being the greenest city in the world.
So Gregor describes the party's politics and priorities as having been consistent over the years. He says they've always been a diverse party, concerned with homelessness and enhancing Vancouver's livability and environmental standing. And that does seem like a decent summary of what Vision Vancouver stands for. A list of political aspirations much more moderate and palatable than those of the party from which Vision originates.
So with these candidates and all you fantastic volunteers, we can go out into the streets, knock on the doors, share our platform, and if we work hard, we can actually get the city we need. Yay! And that city includes winning a rent freeze where landlords can't raise rents 4% every year and where they can't raise rents as much as they like between tenancies. Yes. It includes a city where we use city powers to stop rent evictions in their tracks right now. Yes. It includes restoring indigenous land and working with indigenous nations for housing land trusts and to get that Aboriginal Healing and Wellness Center in the downtown east side. Yes. It means finally getting a ward system so you don't need big money to get elected. Yes. It means ending the criminalization of poverty and homelessness and transferring some of that money saved into services that people really need.
That's longtime anti-poverty advocate and Cope City Council candidate Jean Swanson at her June 2018 campaign launch. Jean also ran for mayor under Cope's banner in 1988. Cope, or the Coalition of Progressive Electors, was founded exactly 50 years ago in 1968 by the Vancouver and District Labor Council. Historically, Cope has fought for the kind of things Jean talks about at her June campaign launch: affordable housing, environmental protection, and social justice initiatives like demanding women's rights and indigenous rights. In 2002, Cope, for the first time in its existence, won a majority on city council plus the mayor's seat. They broke the NPA's long-running control of council, which had spanned from 1986 till 2002. This was a big deal, a historic victory, some might say. But it wasn't long before COPE found itself at a major crossroads.
Left-wing COPE conquered council in the Vancouver Parks Board 7 months
ago. The BC Liberals had been elected as the provincial government in 2001, and it's sort of a general rule, not always, but, you know, it's been a bit of a rule that when there is a right-wing government in Victoria, then the city swings left and vice versa. So, you know, most of the time that the NDP was in power in the 90s, the NPA ran the city, and then in 2002, you know, there was a sense as we were all preparing to cover that election that things were going to be really different.
That's Frances Beulah. Frances was the Vancouver City Hall reporter for the Vancouver Sun from 1994 until 2008. She was a prominent reporter and commentator during the rise of COPE. In addition to the shift in provincial government, Frances says a number of factors played to COPE's advantage, such as the deteriorating state of the downtown east side and the mayor, Philip Owens, fracturing relationship with the NPA. But there was one element in particular that Frances attributes to COPE's 2002 election sweep.
And what really, you know, put the bow on it was in September, suddenly COPE came out and said, we have this new mayoral candidate, somebody you might have heard of, Larry Campbell, who was a very well-known coroner, and there was a TV show, Da Vinci's Inquest, that had been based on him, essentially.
So Larry Campbell was a bit of a celebrity. Ann Roberts, a COPE city councillor during Larry's reign in 2002, recalls his star power and charm. But his politics? Ann says Larry was suggested to run for mayor by a few persuasive people within the party, but that most COPE members weren't especially familiar with his politics.
And it was Jeff Meigs and Stephen Leary, some of the others more very aligned with the NDP, who I call the backroom boys, the ones within the party who, you know, sort out the campaign strategy and that. And they had brought him forward, so they had talked to him more about his politics. I think most of us weren't very aware. We didn't have that opportunity with long, long conversations or all. So, you know, he was brought forward, and I think the membership at that time, he seemed, obviously very charming, genial, interesting person with a great background. And I guess on that basis, people then voted for him. They certainly was welcomed with open arms into to the campaign.
Larry had a lot of clout and some really progressive ideas about drug reform. But his politics didn't align with COPE's social democratic base. Frances comments.
You know, and everything looked really good for about a week. And then everybody realized that there were some real fractures in that party because Larry Campbell was not some diehard, you know, socialist leftist. And some people in COPE really were. I mean, they, you know, Tim Lewis, who wore Che Guevara T-shirts all the time, and Ann Roberts, you know, who'd been pretty committed to left-wing causes forever. And so, you know, almost from the beginning, everyone was aware that there was, you know, a split in that party.
This split famously became known in the media as COPE and COPE Lite. COPE Lite, of course, included the more moderate centrist councillors and friends of Larry Campbell, Jim Green, Tim Stevenson, and Raymond Louis. COPE original city councillor Ann Roberts remembers this divide as being so real it was sometimes funny.
At one point, Larry made a remark to some of us of, look, while you guys were smoking dope as hippies, I was an RCMP officer arresting you. And I said, I bet you were smoking a bit of dope yourself there on the side. And he said, I mean, very seriously, and I totally believe him, he said, absolutely not. I never smoked that. I mean, he was a police officer, right? So you, there again, you see some of the different cultures that came together.
By 2005, Cope Light, or Friends of Larry Campbell, had formed their own party, Vision Vancouver. What seemed like a meaningful shift in Vancouver politics, a move from the city's most conservative party, the NPA, to its most progressive in Cope's 2002 election sweep, never really was. The question lingers around whether Cope was ever voted in for its social democratic politics, or if it had all been about Larry Campbell's star power and the centrist leanings of Cope members like Jeff Meggs, folks Ann Roberts refers to as the backroom boys. Frances says Cope was always too doctrinaire to rule the city. She says traditionally, Vancouverites might choose a couple left-leaning politicians for government, but never a majority.
So there's always been this willingness to, like, elect people who, a couple of people who can be the watchdogs, but not ever let them be in charge. And I have to say, I think that's actually fairly typical of Vancouver. People think it's such a lotus land, woohoo, you know, everyone's wearing Lululemon and goes to, you know, meditation camps all the time. And in actual fact, like, Vancouver's got some pretty strong conservative foundations. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a city built on exploiting resources and real estate speculation. Mm-hmm. So guess who you get? Mm-hmm. Living in your city, when that's one of the economic basics.
In the 2005 civic election, the one right after Cope's rise to power in 2002, the NPA swung back into control with a majority on council. Following that election, Vision Vancouver took majority in 2008 and has held that majority up until today. So what of the former Cope Light? This year, Vision's mayor and four of their councillors aren't seeking re-election. After ruling the city for a decade, what is the party's strategy for this October?
I'm going to say this. This is the first time I've said it out loud for a recording. I think Vision accepts they can't win, and they're just trying to get some placeholders, and they're trying to show the city who they are, so that will kind of embed itself in voters' minds for the next election. I think they don't think that they're going to win this election. But what they want to do is, as, you know, this new council gets elected and, you know, we proceed on to whatever it is, 2022, they want to embed an image of themselves in people's minds as super diverse, young, you know, first group to run a major party, to run like an Indigenous candidate for mayor, you know, all of these good things that, you know, maybe in 4 years after people have seen whatever happens on the next council, will go, well, you know, Vision's not so bad. Like, maybe we should go back to them. That is my guess about what their long-term bet is. And it's also very typical that when parties are going down, that's when they let all the minority candidates and women in, right? Well, you know, Kim Campbell, chosen as the Conservatives are going down. Rita Johnson, chosen as the Premier as the SOCREDs are going down. Ujjal Dosanjh, chosen by the NDP as the NDP is going down. Like, that's typically when your non-standard candidates get a break.
Frances also says we should be careful not to discount Vision. They're a party filled with experienced politicians from many levels of government. As far as ideology goes, it seems like the Vision Vancouver of 2018 is, as Gregor Robertson says, fairly consistent with the Vision of 2008 or even 2005. They are a centrist party in favor of livability, greening the city, ending homelessness, and as Frances suggests, they may even have a plan for losing strategically in this year's election. But what about Cope? Ann Roberts, who is also running for Cope City Council this year, says the party has remained true to its roots and is still the most left of the major civic parties. She says Vision has always been indebted to outside actors, whereas Cope has not, and this difference is part of what defines them.
Mm. But over time, I think Vision developed collecting money, most of their donations from the real estate industry in one form or another, the developers, the gambling industry. They also got very much supported by labor, the Vancouver and District Labor Council. Mm-hmm. But increasingly, most of their money came from developers. And over time, you know, if you're going to continue to get money for developers, you're going to have policies that they are happy with. So I think that then that is, to me, the most crucial difference between Vision and Koch.
It's no secret that Vision has had a close relationship with Vancouver's property development and real estate sector. And despite this, Vision has retained power. So what does this say about progressive politics in Vancouver? Francis suggests Vision's way of running things may be where Vancouver finds a comfortable political middle ground.
The reality is that until the revolution comes, you do have to rely on private developers to build housing. Until the revolution comes and all development companies can be nationalized and run by the Central Soviet, the reality is that you have to grapple with private developers building housing. Mm. And the whole trick for any council is, how do you manage that? Mm. You know, mm-hmm. given that you do have to work in a system like that, that you're not going to suddenly walk into a world where the federal and provincial governments are going to say, here's $2 billion apiece, go out and hire, you know, a feminist collective to knit you an apartment building. Like, that is not going to happen probably within our lifetimes. So, you know, there is a group that says, we just have to deal with these people, and what kind of rules are we going to set? And that's always the difficulty. How much can you push? How much can you demand of private companies to achieve your social goals before they go, screw this, we're out of here? So, and some people are just sort of like, oh, well, give them whatever they want. Like, you know, private companies, the marketplace, it's all good. And others are like, okay, they're not bad people, but we have to set some rules, because if we don't set rules, what happens is they are going to respond to what the market allows them to do. So that's been the dilemma for all of the, you know, anyone who's on any council, really, and particularly in Vancouver, where there is so much development and it's so high stakes.
If it's true that you need to work with developers in a city like Vancouver, and if COPE, despite its support relative to other left-wing municipal parties in Canada, is still seen as too radical by most people, does that mean COPE's best-case scenario is a couple seats on council? Should COPE be changing?
The thing is, though, that if you modify your message, if you modify your platform in order to get elected, then in order to get along, in order to all be alike, you're right. Just then crowded around the middle. And then really, you know, what's the point?
So is the middle where we all come together, or is it where we lose ourselves? Are centrist political parties the ultimate feat of democracy? As Vancouver moves closer towards its October 20th civic election, it's worth wondering whether our municipal government should be seeking to find palatable political compromises or trying to represent the city's varied, sometimes extreme, governing ideologies. Would our system be improved if we had proportional representation? What about having a ward system in Vancouver? What are our options, and which is the best fit for this city? Thanks for listening. This story was reported by Alex DeBoer and Zubin Shroff Marabudi. Editing, production, and research by Alex DeBoer. Music by Artem Bemba and Kai Engel. Special thanks to Francis Bula, Anne Roberts, and CITR 101.9 FM. Seeking Office is brought to you by CITR's News Collective and produced by Alex DeBoer. Our theme music is by Artem Bemba. Thank you for listening.
You know what's better than reading a great magazine? Reading a great magazine that also helps you fight poverty. Megaphone Magazine is sold by homeless and low-income vendors on the streets of Vancouver and Victoria. Vendors buy magazines for 75 cents and sell them for $2. It's flexible, low-barrier work for people who may not have access to traditional jobs. Download the Megaphone app to find vendors and buy the magazine, even when you don't have change. Damascus returns for its fourth year. Join us on July 31st as this fundraiser brings the soul of Syria to the heart of Vancouver with music, storytelling, dancing, wine, and food. All proceeds go to support queer Syrian refugees. For more information and tickets, visit eveningindamascus.com.
And we're back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We're going to end the show off with a fun little piece in honor of the Discovery Channel's Shark Week. Zoe and Aiden take us on a whale of a tale all about sharks on the West Coast. Let's take a listen.
Last month on June 21st, Daily Hive reported that a local woman sighted a shark fin during her morning walk on Kitsilano Beach near Bayswater Street. Surprised by the sighting, she quickly snapped a photo of the shark and shared it on social media. The aquarium confirmed that the shark most likely was an adult Pacific spiny dogfish shark.
Dogfish? Mate, you call that a shark? Come on, surely BC has some bigger sharks than that out here.
Yeah, so in Canada we have 27 species of sharks, and a lot of people don't realize that we have that many. But on the Pacific coast we have 14, and there are about seven, so about half of those 14 are very common. So that includes spiny dogfish. So if you've ever gone fishing for salmon, people often catch spiny dogfish instead because they eat similar things to salmon and they live in similar places. And so those are small sharks that usually get to about a meter long. And also thresher sharks, which are really cool. Everybody loves thresher sharks. They have the really long top part of their tails. So they whip those to stun groups of fish and eat them. And also some deep water sharks, some really cool ones. We have six-gill sharks that are like big, ancient sharks that move quite slowly and live in really cold, deep waters. Also the blue shark that's now been featured on our stamps. There are five new postal stamps that are featuring Canadian sharks, and one of them is the blue shark. So yeah, we have quite a few species. Pretty cool.
That was Madeline Cashin, a fisheries conservation and policy scientist who recently graduated from UBC specializing in ecology and shark and ray research.
This Sheila knows a lot about sharks for a Canadian.
And, you know, we asked her about what type of sharks we should be afraid of, and this was her answer.
I know. The fact is that you're really not going to run into these sharks probably ever if you live in BC. The only way that you would maybe is if you were on a fishing vessel or maybe far out on a boat. But otherwise, you're probably not going to see them. And if you do see them, it's such a rare occurrence. I mean, there are some crazy statistics about, like, more people are bitten in New York City by people a year than sharks worldwide by humans. So, yeah. And, like, I could keep going. Like, vending machines kill more people than sharks. Like, it's about the frequency, right? If you don't see them, you're not going to have a problem with them. And just like if you were wandering, like, the African savannah by yourself, you'd be wary of running into maybe some big cats, like lions. And that's something you've got to keep in mind. More in tropical areas of the world, but even on our coast, I mean, it's always good to just know, you know, to be wary of where you are. But I would say, like, other hazards like drowning are a much bigger issue for us.
Mate, I am not going to New York City anytime soon. Tell you that for free. Right, and you know what else Mad Dog Matto knows about sharks?
Okay, this is, I tell everybody this one, but my favorite shark fact is that sharks have been on the earth longer than trees. So they evolved before trees did, which is just unreal to think about. And also, because they've been on this earth so long, they've had a really had a chance to evolve and kind of like penetrate all parts of the ocean and rivers and lakes as well in some cases. So there are just a lot of species.
Whoa, that's actually kind of frightening that they're going into lakes and rivers.
Mate, you reckon that's frightening? What about global warming?
So it's definitely true that we're going to start seeing different kinds of shark species, and we've already seen a couple different species that we're not used to seeing, or a higher frequency of the warm water sharks that don't visit us very often. So, and that includes great white sharks. I know everybody wants to hear about great white sharks. And on both coasts of Canada, sorry, there are three coasts, but on the Pacific and the Atlantic coast, we have definitely are seeing a higher abundance of white sharks coming in seasonally.
Crikey!
We asked Madeline how we should be celebrating Shark Week, and this was her answer.
Well, you know, I don't really watch Shark Week, unfortunately. I feel a little bit of guilt about it, but I'm just not interested in a lot of the shows that are on there. The good news is that a lot of those shows are starting to be more based on fact and featuring actual researchers, which is exciting. But I would just say pick the shows carefully and do something to help the oceans. There's a lot of great causes you can donate money or time to, especially if you live on the coast. I mean, find out if there's a shoreline cleanup. Maybe donate to a local NGO, spend some time with them, because that's really what they need is time and always money, obviously. So, and that's the best way to help sharks, is just to get involved.
Yeah, mate, that's the spirit. Help the cute little nippers out.
Happy Shark Week.
Happy Shark Week. Happy Shark Week. Shark Week.
And that was Democracy Watch for Thursday, July 26th. Thanks so much for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. Join us again next Thursday at 5 p.m. for more local news. And don't forget to subscribe to our new Civic Elections podcast, Seeking Office. Seeking Office is available for wherever you get your podcasts.